Although there are several qualities that people feel children should have, every person thinks that some are more important than others. I'm going to read you pairs of desirable qualities. Please tell me which one you think is more important for a child to have. Independence versus respect for elders. Obedience versus self-reliance. Curiosity versus good manners. Being considerate versus being well-behaved. How you answer those four questions can predict a lot about who you are. Whether you're more likely to live in the city or the suburbs. Whether you're more likely to watch The Amazing Race or Mad Men. To buy coffee at Starbucks or Tim Hortons. To go to church or Sunday brunch. To pursue higher education or not. To drink a Labatt Blue or a local craft beer. Or even to drive a GMC pickup or a Toyota Prius. More important, how you answer says a whole lot about your politics. Welcome back to In Focus with David Coletto. I'm your host, David Coletto. On the podcast this week, I'm joined by Dr. Mark Hetherington and Dr. Jonathan Wheeler, authors of Prius or Pickup, How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide. The book was published in 2018 by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. I read the book a few years ago, and it had a big impact on how I think about public opinion, political behavior, and what impacts both. In their book, Hetherington and Wheeler show that the key to understanding polarization in the United States, in fact, polarization in Canada, the UK, and other countries, requires understanding how personality and worldview impacts opinions and behavior. They also show that these factors also impact what we drive, where we live, where we vacation, and not surprisingly, how we vote. I'm so pleased they both agreed to discuss their book with me. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Mark and Jonathan, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. It's a real pleasure to meet you both.
Thanks so much for having us, David.
Yeah, thank you, David.
I'll have to say that your book, I read it while on vacation 2 years ago, over the Christmas break. It's had a big impact on how I think about public opinion, and in particular, you know, how we come to our views and the impact of things we don't often think about, our personality, how we view the world can play such a big role, not just in our politics, but where we live, you know, what kind of car we drive, and where we like to go on vacation, which actually has turned out to be the most interesting question I've tried to append to the model. I want to start with the basic idea, which is your book argues that you can ask people four questions about child rearing, and based on those answers, you can predict a lot about them, or at least explain a lot about how they think and what they do. What is it about those questions and what they measure that makes them so powerful?
I guess I'll start, and Jonathan, you know, definitely, you know, make sure to chime in, you know, because you know, you have a way of clarifying these things that I probably don't. But there is actually a, you know, these are not our questions. These are ones that we adopted, you know, from the National Election Study, things that had been created by Stanley Feldman and some others. And the basic idea is that it makes people choose between competing values. One being sort of like, you know, being independent and information seeking and so forth versus, you know, being more conforming and, you know, tradition defending, you know, in that sense. And we think that these questions work especially well because they make people make a choice, you know, between those two different very human impulses. And it really, you know, to us gets at the core of what motivates people. Are they, you know, the people who are searchers, you know, who, you know, if we go back to cave person days, you know, left the cave and, you know, went out into the world and tried to discover things, and maybe some of them got eaten by the lion. Or the people who maintain the security, you know, of the, you know, the cave and, you know, maintain their safety and fires burning, you know, in a sense. And, you know, those seem to be like to us these fundamental impulses that different types of people have, some more in one direction. Thing that's interesting is you can't really be both, you know, of those things. You know, you're more one or the other. And the thing that makes them very powerful is that politics has gotten over lane of those, you know, two different impulses that, you know, that different types of people tend to have.
And I would just add, David, you know, I think one of the things that's so interesting about these parenting questions or these parenting choices, so people are asked, do they prefer that kids respect elders or that they think for themselves or that they're independent or that they have good manners? These are the questions themselves have nothing to do with politics. And that's a lot of what gives them their power because, among other things, I think that gives us a lot of confidence that what we're identifying is, as we talk about, the word we use all the time is a worldview that's really independent of politics, but in a particular context, and I know we're going to get into this, a particular historical context, those worldviews become profoundly politically relevant. So the nature of the questions, their non-political nature, both in statistical terms and then in just kind of substantive terms, makes them an extraordinarily powerful tool for identifying what's at the root of the way we think about the world.
And Jonathan, just to add here, because those child rearing or parenting preferences seem to also, and you point this out in the book, tie to one's view of how dangerous the world actually is. And that seems to be the overriding factor in then explaining every other decision or choice that those firmly in each camp, which we'll describe in a moment, and tend to make.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, and I know this is something we'll get into as well, that, you know, everybody experiences danger to some degree, depending on the context and also just depending on their personalities and what scares them. But there's no question that these parenting questions distinguish between people who fear very different things in the world. Mm-hmm. And those very different fears, again, especially given the particular way that politics have sorted themselves out nowadays, are just, you know, a fundamental to understanding why we're divided the way we are.
Mark, you're going to add something.
Yeah. And, you know, if you think the world is dangerous, you know, then what you're going to want to do is to cluster together, you know, hang together, follow the traditions and pathways, you know, the sort of more fixed worldview, the things that have worked in the past to keep the tribe safe. And if, you know, that's not as much of a priority for you, then, you know, you can explore the world. You can leave the cave. You right. can, you know, do all of those types of things that only a perception of safety and security allows you to do. But one thing that I do think is really critical is, and this has come up in the context of COVID, is we have this really strange, you know, situation where the people who have a more fixed worldview, who tend to see more dangers in the world, are oddly, at least in the United mm-hmm. States, the same people who are not wearing masks and are minimizing the dangers of the virus. And we've spent a good bit of time, Jonathan and I, doing research on this during the course of the pandemic. And we found this really interesting distinction. And it seems to be that these sort of more fixed worldview people, it's tangible threats, you know, things mm-hmm. that you physically see, personifiable threats, immigrants, people of color, terrorists, things like that, that you can see. That are concerning to that group of people. Whereas the more fluid worldview people actually seem to be people who are more frightened by non-personifiable threats like a virus or climate change mm-hmm. or, you know, sort of more systemic forces. And we've gotten, you know, kind of under the hood of that a little bit during the course of the last 6 months.
That's really interesting because I always wondered that, like, what is it about climate change that makes, and in our, even when I run the data in Canada, it's the most polarizing issue. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, COVID-19 is now another example of that, right? There's this virus that most of us hopefully will never experience, but it's there. And why is it that some fear it and others don't as much? So I want to build on this. You ask these four questions, and then you take the responses and you sort those answers into, you basically create three or five groups, depending on how you look at it. You've got on one side, those that you describe as having a fixed worldview. They're more likely to, you know, say that, you know, children should respect elders, should be obedient, should, you know, less creative, less sort of do your own thing and more follow the kind of path that's been set before. And then on the other end, you've got those you describe as fluid. They're the opposite. They like creativity and openness and exploration. And then a big group in the middle, which you describe as mixed. And they can lean towards the fixed or the fluid and be pure mixed in the sense that they don't have any particular direction. So that's how we get these groups in terms of the data and pulling those questions in. So how about, I'll start with Mark. You describe as quickly as you can who the fixed are, and then Jonathan, I'll look to you to describe the fluid. But for the audience, how would you describe, I guess, the purest form of the fixed first, Mark?
Well, so let me just put it in terms of demographic groups. I think that might be a useful way to go. When we're talking about people who have fixed worldviews, they tend to be people who are highly religious and a specific type of religious commitment. You know, those who have a tendency to believe in a sort of literal interpretation of the Bible, a word for word, as opposed to more interpretive understanding of the Bible. So people who are born again Christians, evangelicals, you know, that sort of approach, the fundamentalist approach to things. Also people who are lower in education. So, you know, those with a high school degree or less are much more likely to be fixed in worldview. Older people, perhaps not surprisingly, are especially likely to have fixed worldviews as well. So, you know, again, it's this type of understanding of the world tends to covary and you know, with exactly the types of groups that we think of as the most Republican groups in the United States. So, of course, the religious conservatives, what we now refer to as working class whites, you know, so whites with less than a college education and such. This is the core of what it means to be a Republican these days.
And you describe in the book, you know, these are folks who are warier of social and cultural change, and hence more set in their ways, more suspicious of outsiders, and more comfortable with the familiar and predictable, right? Like they are, in a way, like I think of my father, who will go to the restaurant and order the same thing over and over and over because he knows what he's going to get. He's not going to, you know, take the chef's special that he doesn't have any idea what it is because that's risky, right? He may not get what he wants.
David, it's such a great, you know, putting it in terms of like restaurants is such a great idea. You know, so one of the stories that we tell in the book is about Mike Pence, and Pence goes to New York, you know, the greatest restaurant town in the United States, and he goes to Applebee's. And the reason he goes to Applebee's is it's just like it is in Indiana. You know, he just is not interested in that, you know, type of adventurousness, whereas Barack Obama would not have gone to Applebee's when he went to New York.
Yeah. And so, Jonathan, on the complete opposite side, you've got the fluid folks. Who are they and what makes them unique to the others?
Yeah, so I guess also thinking, you know, to some degree in kind of demographic and geographic terms, we are certainly more likely to find fluid folks in big cities, big polyglot cities like New York and San Francisco and Boston, where there's just a tremendous range of cultures and languages and different, I mean, speaking of food, different kinds of cuisine that's available, and that in fact, the reason that people who are fluid, and it's not just coincidental that we're more likely to find those folks in big cities, there's been clear geographic sorting in the United States in recent decades. And folks who are attracted to the rainbow, to diversity, are more likely to gravitate to cities, and that has increasingly been younger people with college educations or more who just like to experience in their minds, you know, all that the world has to offer. And in some ways for them, I think it's interesting when they think about America, they think about America as encompassing the world as opposed to America as a safe haven from the world. And so I think that's, and so, yeah, I guess in a nutshell, I would say that would be the sort of paradigmatic version of a fluid person.
The other comparison using sort of the restaurant analogy is travel. In a survey I did in Canada, we sorted the people into fluid and fixed, and we asked, where would you more likely go on vacation? Orlando or Florence? And it's not perfect. Like, none of this stuff is perfect, black or white, but there's a strong relationship, correlation between if you're fixed, you're going to Orlando. And if you're fluid, you much rather go to Florence. Right. And that to me sums it up.
I love that question, by the way. That's great.
Yeah, it's a great idea.
Right. It sums it up to me. Like, I'd rather go to Disneyland because I know what I'm going to get. It's consistent. I can get the same food. I can go to those chains that I like. Florence or a place like Thailand, that's foreign, right? It's foreign to me, and that matters. So
just to toss this in real quickly, David, because, you know, I think Jonathan and I have both experienced this book, you know, our ideas, where they come from, very much is from our interpersonal contact with just people around us. And, you know, I lived in suburban Tennessee for 15 years before coming to North Carolina. And my son plays baseball, and you know, you spend a lot of time sitting at the ballpark with the parents of the other kids on the team. And, you know, during this period, you know, I started to get these opportunities to travel to different places to give talks on the book. And one of the things that came up all the time from the people who I was chatting with at the ballpark, mostly fixed worldview people, was like, why would you leave the United States? I mean, what's wrong with what we have here? You know, I'd be so excited about going to Florence or going to, you know, London, and they just don't get it, you know, and, you know, in the same way that I simply don't get why Disney World, you know, we have 16 and 20 year old kids and we've never been to Disney World. Yeah. You know, it's just such an interesting, I mean, your idea about how to get at this is so smart. You know, it's a real strong fault line.
And just, I mean, let's just dwell on that point. Because you just described the challenge in these worldviews is that people from either end don't even understand why, you know, the others think the way they do. They can't even imagine it, right? That's the risk, is that if they, as you described, get sorted politically into two parties, as it wasn't, and we'll talk about that in a moment, because I think that's an important history of all of this. But if that happens, then how do you find common ground when I don't even understand or can't even relate at all to why you do what you do or why you think what you do?
Well, and David, to sort of connect this to the politics themselves, in a different era when our vacation preferences and our political preferences had nothing to do with each other, and really there's no reason why they should, everything we're describing would just be a curiosity. Mm-hmm. But now, because everything is connected, it's all loaded. And so when you hear somebody express a preference about coffee or restaurant or whatever, your antenna are probably already up, that this person doesn't just have a different idea about what they like to eat, but they might also have other different ideas, which are much more problematic. And so I think this is what's so loaded about the political era we're now in, is the interconnection of all of these things.
Yeah, I think that's totally right, Jonathan. And, you know, it reminds me of a story involving my dad and my brother. You know, my brother is the, you know, classic fluid worldview guy. I mean, you know, really, frankly, a saintly character. And my dad is, you know, another saintly character, but in a different way. You know, he's a fixed worldview guy who's a, you know, veteran of the Korean War and so forth. And this was a couple of years after 9/11 happened, and we were taking a walk in the neighborhood, and they were, my brother and my dad, you know, always argued about politics. And Brian was talking about how important it was to preserve civil liberty freedoms, you know, so, you know, it was probably not a good idea to, you know, spy on people without warrants and to tap people's phone calls and things like that. And Dad said, you know, all those liberties, they're all well and good until you're dead, you know. And, you know, I mean, it's just a completely different worldview. Like, you know, the safety is the center of what, you know, Dad is thinking about. You know, if we don't have that, we don't have anything. And my brother's like, it's not that dire, Dad. You know, we can have civil liberties too. But, you know, those are irreconcilable, you know, views of the world.
So just briefly, because I think it's important to set the context, how big are each of these groups relative to the mixed kind of group?
Well, it really depends on how you measure these things, right? I mean, if we only use these, you know, four questions, and we can probably improve on that. We've been kind of working on it. But, you know, you end up with, you know, there are more people in the middle, you know, than there are at the very ends. But there are plenty of people at the really, you know, sort of far ends of things. So I guess, you know, we would probably have at the very end points, probably about 35% of the people, you know, probably about 20% at the fixed end, 15% at the fluid end, and then, you know, some people who are in between. But the really critical problem is that, and this is something Jonathan can speak to, I think, best, is when the parties have been captured by people who are either fixed or fluid, the people in the middle have to make a choice. You know, it's not like they can exert their own worldview, because the people who dominate the major parties are the very fixed and the very fluid. And so they end up, the folks in the middle have to choose a side.
They are, as Mark said, they're faced, especially in the United States, given our two-party political system, they are faced with a starkly binary choice. Well, the third choice is just to sit it out. But it will also mean that circumstances will very much influence sort of which way they will lean. So, you know, after traumatic events like 9/11, a lot are likely to lean one way, and in other circumstances, they might be more up for grabs.
It's really interesting, you know, when you reflect on our political leaders, whether in the US or Canada, you really do see that like distilled version of these, right? Like, as you described, Obama versus Mike Pence or Trump. Trump feels like he's fixed, or he has got rhetoric of a fix, but I'm never sure where he actually falls on this. He's probably more mixed than wherever he wants to go. But in Canada, you know, our current Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, is, I think, a quintessential fluid worldview. And then the previous Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, if you know of him, or you've, you know, seen him, he's the most fixed. He's like very much like Mike Pence, right? Very solid and straightforward, and like stability is most important. And so we really do see that divide, which pulls, I think, people. But then, so now you've got, when we're recording this, President-elect Biden, it seems to me that here's a political leader who, if I'm, without him asking him those four questions, feels like he's more mixed, right? That he's not, he's probably leaning towards the fluid, but maybe not. Maybe he's like a pure mixed. And so he comes out of the chaos that is the world today. And I find that really interesting, that the Democrats could have gone with, you know, somebody like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, who I think is the ultimate fluid in the party at the time, but instead chose somebody who really didn't, you know, align with that purity. Do you think is that, I guess, because at the end of your book, you talk about, okay, how do we bridge the divide? Is Joe Biden an example of, even though it was still a highly divided electorate, is it an example of how the system could still maybe produce a less polarizing political leader out of all of this?
Well, you know, I don't know how big of a difference a given political leader will make, you know, in this whole process, but your observation is exactly right. I mean, you know, Biden Biden won the election, you know, some of the post-election analysis we've done suggests that the reason that he won was not by winning more fluid people. There were no more fluid people to win. You know, he peeled off just enough more fixed people in rural areas in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Georgia and places like that, you know, to be able to win. So, you know, the Democrats purposefully chose, and, you know, the party really got involved in making this happen. If the party hadn't, you know, forced all of the other moderates to drop out of the race, we would have ended up with Bernie Sanders as the nominee, and I think the election would have turned out quite differently. But, you know, we got a white guy, white male, from working class roots, and, you know, at least grew up in Scranton, Pennsylvania, which is, you know, sort of the capital of fixedness, you know, in a lot of ways. And that was just enough, you know, in order to attract, you know, some of those people, probably more in the middle of the spectrum that, you know, might have gone, you know, for the Republicans and Trump otherwise. Because the interesting thing is, you know, in those, you know, really fluid areas that Jonathan was talking about, the polyglot Philadelphias and places along those lines, Biden actually didn't do as well as Hillary Clinton did 4 years before. He lost support in places like there and Miami and places like that, but he picked up support in rural Pennsylvania and suburban Philadelphia and places like that.
But David, to follow up on your question about, or at least your sort of wondering about whether somebody like Biden could at least shift the field of play a little bit. And here I'll just be more blatantly partisan. As long as the American right is as steeped in conspiracy theory as it is, and its major media outlets are amplifying that, I think this goes back in some ways back to this sort of question of who are all these people in the middle, who maybe somebody like Biden is actually comforting to them, makes it easier for them to see themselves voting for the Democratic Party or conceiving of a more moderate way. That's possible. But I think we're also in a period now where elites, especially on the right, just make it very difficult for us to, because Biden is being himself being branded as a socialist and a tool of the radicals and the Marxist left. And, you know, not everybody buys that, but from that perspective, he's just being folded into, you know, the same Manichaean divide that everybody else is.
Yeah, that's a good point, Jonathan. And the other thing that I would just add is, you know, is there anybody in the Democratic Party who would pick up the mantle from Biden to continue to sort of evolve the party in a different way? And, you know, I don't see anybody. He's a pretty much a set of one among Democrats these days with that kind of profile. You know, most of the people he was matching up with in the primaries were, you know, again, as you said, you know, especially Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, you know, quite a lot different.
Well, I think, Jonathan, to your point about when we talk about sorting, we won't have time to get into the history of it, but in the book you describe the sorting and, you know, of these worldviews into the political system, where in the 1950s you might have had not equal numbers, but as many fluids and worldview and fixed sitting in caucus in the Republican Party as you did in the Democrats, right? There was a mix because you'd have Northern and Southern Democrats and Western and Midwest Republicans. But now that's kind of sorted itself out. Biden actually represents maybe the last of that generation, because he was elected in the 70s to the Senate and, you know, was very proud of his bipartisanship and working across aisles, in part because he could find people on the other side who at least he could connect with. That's much harder to do today, right? I'm not even sure if Susan Collins, you know, probably maybe the most moderate Republican senator, you know, is even, you know, closest to the most moderate, well, maybe Joe Manchin, West Virginia, but he really you know, he's probably the exception in terms of being a Democrat in that caucus right now.
Well, David, just quickly to your point, Mark wrote an article, a very widely cited article 20 years ago about elite polarization. And it was around 20 years ago that it became true that the most conservative Democrat in Congress was to the left of the least conservative Republican. That there was, up until the 90s, there was at least some crossover. And as of, what was it, Mark, the late 90s, I guess,
that they
lost contact. And so that's a process that's been underway for decades and has solidified itself, particularly over the last generation or so.
Yeah, back in the 70s, you know, there used to be in the House of Representatives, you know, almost 100 members, you know, who were completely in the middle, in the sense that the Democrats were more conservative than some of the Republicans, and the Republicans were more liberal than some of the Democrats. And if you have 80 members out of the 435 in the House, you can make some pretty interesting coalitions to make policy.
Right.
But what's happened, but again, one of the reasons, you know, for that is that the issues that divided us changed. You know, there was a middle when it came to issues involving class. You know, how much should government do? A little bit more, a little bit less. You know, that gets a lot of people in the middle. But when the politics changes to be about civil rights for minorities, women's rights, LGBT rights, terrorism, immigration, the center disappears. You know, these are more binary as opposed to issues that allow for compromise. And now the center is completely hollowed out in Congress.
One of the really, I think, fascinating things about using these worldviews to understand people's other views is just looking at what issues they care about or what issues they think are problems. I think we already alluded to this, but it's become clear to me, even in Canada, that we are increasingly agreeing less on what the problems are. Right, so we talked about climate change as an example, or illegal immigration, or coronavirus. Right, those are examples where, if political divide in the U.S. is there because you've had the sorting, but if you look at the worldview groups, you know, they almost 90% of fluids say yes, climate change is a crisis, and almost like only 10 or 15% of fixed say the same thing. So if you don't even agree on what the problem is, how the heck are we going to ever agree on what a solution might be, right? So I think that's the starting point. But what's interesting, and we're recording this just as Congress is figuring out what to do about stimulus checks. And there was a poll that came out yesterday that showed 77% of Americans support the $2,000 checks. 12%, I think, are opposed. And the one issue where I've always seen actually alignment comes on economic issues, right? Where you could find actually common ground between fixed and fluid on the rich don't pay enough in tax. Government should be doing more to help people or reduce inequality, right? Like while fixed folks probably want less government, they also see that the system's kind of rigged against them. And so don't mind when government sends checks out, right? And so in a way, Trump and Pelosi in this current are actually aligned and have found a way to unite. And the remaining 12% are like the corporatist old, you know, Mitt Romney Republicans who say we shouldn't be doing this, right? Like that's socialism. So I think there are issues, and economic ones, it seems to me, are ones that actually can find common ground between these groups, maybe for different reasons, and they might be fearing different things. But this example showed me that you could actually find a huge consensus in the United States on an issue that you maybe assumed you wouldn't be able to.
Well, just to add quickly to that, David, the reason that the $600 stimulus checks got into the coronavirus relief bill that passed was largely because Bernie Sanders and Josh Hawley, who's a very conservative senator from Missouri, really pushed that together. And so, again, and they are about as opposite ends of the spectrum as you can get. So I agree that they're interesting politics. And I would add to that, I mean, I think this goes to, and it's something that Mark and I have talked about a lot the last couple of years, In the first book we wrote in 2009, Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics, we were really focused on just public opinion, the mass, et cetera. And in recent years, I think we've thought a lot more about elites and how important they are to just shaping this entire political landscape. If Donald Trump were not in favor of $2,000 relief checks, those polling numbers you just cited would be very different, right? The mere fact that he endorsed them took them from yet one more issue we're completely divided over to a near consensus. And again, I think that's one basic example of the incredibly important role that elites play in stoking this kind of division.
And that's such an important, you know, point in a class studying public opinion, because one argument is it doesn't really exist. It's simply what elites decide, and they pull the levers, and, you know, we just follow along, which is a really interesting point. And I think Trump is a perfect example of that over and over throughout the years. You know, the most pro-free trade party becomes the most anti. The most anti-Russia becomes the most pro-Russia in literally seconds. That doesn't happen if public opinion is something that's durable and based on something that's deeper. So the elite cues that these world different folks from different worldviews follow is, I think, a really important part of what you've uncovered here. I want to end our conversation by just seeing how, you know, your book and the ideas in that book can extend beyond the U.S. Because obviously, my colleague Frank Graves, who I interviewed on an earlier podcast, is a big, you know, fan of yours as well, and has done a lot of work looking at, you know, the Canadian landscape through the same lens. I think you can apply it in Brexit in the UK. You've seen the same kind of sorting, even in the last UK election. You know, you had the Conservatives winning constituencies that the Labour Party had held for years because class was originally the driver, but now it appears more and more worldview is, and Brexit has become that issue that's divided the country between cosmopolitan London and everywhere else, England, right? Which I find really interesting. So on that point, like, are you, I guess I've answered my own question. I think it is applicable elsewhere. And that's sometimes rare when we use theories and ideas coming from the United States, because it's sometimes hard to compare the US to other countries. We try to do it all the time in Canada, as your neighbor just to the north, but it rarely works. But this case, I think it does. Have you done other research? Have you collaborated with other colleagues in looking at how this extends beyond the US?
Yeah, you know, this is actually, I think, the neatest thing that we've, you know, had underway. You know, we partnered with some people in Britain and, you know, did find this really strong relationship between these four questions and attitudes about Brexit. We found the same in France as it related to voting for the National Front Party there, voting for the AfD in Germany versus Greens in Germany. We have a friend who put our survey questions in the field in Brazil, and not surprisingly, the results in Brazil were staggering, actually, how strongly being fixed predicted support for Bolsonaro. You know, we've done some more work along those lines. But the thing that I would point back to is the beginning of our conversation, you know, why should this be? And the reason I think that it is that what we, I think, you know, kind of stumbled upon was a human impulse, you know, and that it's a human impulse no matter where you are, you know, if it's in South America or in Europe or in North America, you know, are you fixed or fluid? Are you, you know, the type of person who is more interested in leaving the safety of the cave and going to Florence, or would you rather, you know, kind of, you know, shore up the foundation of defense that you have at home? And that's going to hold, you know, across the human condition.
Except, as you point out in the book, in the U.S., and I'm seeing it in Canada, people of color. Maybe we can just end on that note, that when you look at, you know, Black Americans, even Hispanic Americans, that they exhibit more fixed worldviews at times, but they don't vote that way.
Right.
What do you think explains that? And I think I see that in the data in Canada, that new Canadians, you know, we have a much more kind of diverse group, but whether they're South Asian, Chinese Canadian, they exhibit those same fixed views, but don't always vote for the Conservative Party here. That to me is both an opportunity for conservative politicians who want to take advantage of that, but also I think prevents those fixed from completely dominating the political system in the US as well.
Yeah, it's a really interesting balancing act, right? Because, you know, the fixed policies may well, and we saw this a little bit in the 2020 election in the United States, where Trump makes some inroads, especially with Latino Americans, because, you know, the sort of more fixed approach to the world is by worldview attractive. But what we find in our work is that, you know, when you're a group that is being actively attacked and discriminated against by a party, your identity as a racial or ethnic minority trumps your worldview. You know, it's just more important, you know, than your worldview if that's the case. But, you know, as people's identities as minorities may ebb, you know, over time, you know, we may well see that changing to some degree. And I think, you know, the last election, you know, kind of suggests that as well. But, you know, oftentimes, you know, people who are from racial and ethnic minorities, you know, have grown up in circumstances that would push someone to be more fixed, to be more concerned about safety and security. You know, those needs have often, you know, not been as easily met as they have been for upper education whites. And so it makes sense that the fixedness would be higher. And if, you know, I think the right would, you know, take a more or less discriminatory approach, they could attract those voters.
You know, just to add to what Mark just said, David, it wasn't that long ago that, you know, George W. Bush, who was president of the United States before Obama, spoke some Spanish, favored comprehensive immigration reform, did quite well among Hispanic, Latino Americans, and believed that, you know, they could be, the Republican Party could be a natural home for them. And after Republicans lost to Obama for the second time in 2012, the party wrote this report called The Autopsy, in which they said, we have to stop alienating non-white Americans. They're just too big a share of the electorate now. This was in 2012. And then in 2016, you know, they turned around and nominated Donald Trump. And so, I mean, I think there is this tension in the Republican Party between those who recognize that there's an opportunity, and as this bloc, you know, becomes an increasing share of the electorate, also a danger for them. But then human behavior being what it is, of course, Donald Trump won the largest share of the non-white vote of any Republican since Richard Nixon in 1960.
And just to toss one piece in here too, the left has a real issue with this as well as a governing party right now, because, you know, you have this very fluid, you know, impulse in the party, you know, the real, you know, sort of elites, the folks who embrace the term socialism and, you know, things along those lines. But the racial and ethnic minority groups within the party are not on board with that type of approach, that type of rhetoric. And the reason, of course, is that those groups have much more at stake than, you know, these, you know, very idealistic white liberals. You know, if, you know, the term socialism drives a bunch of people away from the Democratic Party, then they get the Republicans. and that's a disaster for racial and ethnic minorities. So, you know, their approach is liberal, but a more incremental, you know, sort of approach to things. Whereas, you know, the Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and AOC wing of the party is a much more, you know, kind of, we need these fundamental changes. And, you know, it's ironic that the groups that I think they're trying to serve, you know, which are going to be disproportionately racial and ethnic minorities, are the group that is least on board with that kind of approach to fundamental change because they're more fixed.
I want to wrap. I could go on and on and on. There's so much interesting stuff, but I want to finish with one idea, and it builds off of what you just described. And in the US, you have Fox News, so you have a much more divided media. We have some right-wing, you know, media organizations, but nowhere near the kind of sorting even of the audience that you have in the US. But it seems to me that one of the challenges in the media is coming to terms with those that have fixed worldviews. That when Donald Trump gets 47% of the vote and almost wins the election, people are like, how can that even happen, right? And those are, in my view, my mainly fluid folks who are like, I can't imagine how this happens. And so it feels like most journalists, most media commentators in Canada, and I would say outside of Fox News in the United States, are of that fluid, mind you, worldview. It actually becomes hard to report and explain what's going on. And that in itself is perhaps part of the, not the problem, but part of the explanation for that continuing sorting that we're seeing, that even in Canada, when, you know, we have a Conservative Party leader who is going aggressively against China and, you know, talks about issues that most of the mainstream media just don't understand why they're talking about, but actually has big resonance with large pockets of the population, it almost inflames that group because they don't know how to speak to that audience. What are your thoughts on the role of the media in all of this? Because I do see it, and I have friends and colleagues who are solidly fluid and repeatedly can't understand how such a large group of the rest of the country can think this way. And that, I think, is a perfect example of the challenge that this polarization has created in bridging it.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. You know, the thing is, I don't know that media is going to be able to play that role because, you know, people, in addition to being sorted into their parties by worldview, are also sorting into their information sources by worldview. You know, so, you know, to the extent that there was a time in the United States where everybody got their information from the same set of sources, it's past. You know, if we're going to get out of this, I don't think it's going to be the media, you know, that is able to play a positive role in all of this. I think the key thing is going to need to be that the thing that divides us has to change. You know, it's these worldview-based issues, you know, race, immigration, sexual orientation, gender, you know, those types of things that divide us. And that's what produces the polarization. If we went back to a time where we were divided by class again, and you know, you were talking earlier about how, you know, the Republicans and Democrats could find common ground even now on those $2,000 checks, then we could, you know, then we would have a different kind of politics. But that's doesn't seem to be in the cards for at least right now.
I would just add to that. That in the last chapter, in the conclusion of Prius or Pickup, Mark and I always put this in air quotes, our optimistic conclusion is that there will be an environmental calamity of such magnitude, we will no longer be able to stay divided over, that things like some of these cultural issues themselves will seem like child's play compared to the survival of the species. And there is, in fact, some evidence. I mean, I'm thinking about North Carolina, for example. I've seen survey data that shows that in communities where there have been tropical hurricanes, greater frequency of tropical storms, tremendous damage due to climate change, public opinion has changed, in this case, specifically among conservative voters, to be more accepting of the reality of it. And so I think that just speaks to, in some ways, the larger point that Mark is making, that historical circumstances allowed us to sort the way we have so that worldview became politically relevant in the way that it has. And historical circumstances will change again in a way that will re-scramble the issue agenda and therefore the kinds of things that we fight over. But that won't happen tomorrow,
right?
Is the thing.
And it's really fascinating that it likely won't happen despite a global pandemic that has, you know, that has completely disrupted everything about everybody's life. And the President of the United States got it and still you see the kind of divides you have, right?
The pandemic was an amazing test of polarization, and polarization won handily.
Yeah, it's such a good observation, Jonathan. I mean, that's a perfect way of putting it. You know, crises always bring people together, except for in this case. And I think it gets back to something Jonathan said earlier, and that is, you know, the cues that we get from our party leaders really matter a lot. You know, if Donald Trump and, you know, other right-leaning figures in the world had said, man, this is a really serious thing, and we need to pull together in order to solve the problem, everybody would have come together. And in countries where that happened, you know, they would come together. But, you know, the US and Brazil and, you know, these places where there are these right-wing populists, it's just a different story.
I think that's a great way to end, because here, I live in Ontario. Doug Ford is our premier, governor, and he's the brother of Rob Ford. You remember the infamous mayor of Toronto. And he was elected on a fairly populist kind of rhetoric. But he did the opposite of what many of them did. He's taken it seriously. He's talked about how he locked down the province. We're in lockdown right now. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, reiterates the fact that elites have immense power to decide whether worldview matters or not in how our politics is. And I think it's a great way to end the conversation. So Jonathan, Mark, brilliant stuff. And I highly recommend everyone who's listening to go out and pick up a copy of Prius, or pick up How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's, and I think you can add the world's, increasingly great divide. Happy New Year, and thanks again, guys.
Oh, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.